The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Per Anders and Lotta Jorgensen, Fool Magazine, Sweden.
I was born and raised in a very small town called Ystad, which is now famous for the Detective Wallander series. Small city on the very edge of the Swedish Baltic Ocean.
And I was born up north Sweden in a small town called Härnösand, but I've also been living in Lapland as well in Sweden, so I've been living in many different cities.
Give us a little background about Swedish culture. I mean, what are some traditions related back towards food and cuisine?
Food and cuisine traditions. Well, I almost feel like going fetching our latest issue with Magnus Nilsson, describing the whole Swedish history from way, way, way BC and all the way forward. But modern food culture. Good question. We really don't have one. That's the thing. Like Klaus Meyer described here, I was basically fed on the same diet as him. I didn't become that fat, but even my mother, she was a cook, but she really didn't want me in the kitchen, and she didn't like my interest in food, and she was a victim like of women going out working, which is a good thing. But in the late 60s, we turned to not fast food, but processed food in a way. And she stopped cooking. So that was my childhood.
The Swedish tradition of food is, everybody knows about gravad lax and pickled herring and things like that, and smorgasbord. That's the traditional Swedish food, I would say. But the modern Swedish food scene has been evolving now with a couple of really interesting chefs. We have Magnus Nilsson of Färviken, and we have Björn Fransson from Fransson. Before it was Fransson Lindberg, I'm almost saying it again. And a few more, yeah, of course.
But also you remember Swedish... It's, you know, this region is comprised of, it's a very small region, so it's actually, I would speak about like the Nordic or Scandinavian food heritage, I would say, because we are so intervened, we're so kind of tight together in a way.
Yeah, but the food scenes are different from in Finland, Norway,
absolutely.
Denmark and Sweden. It's completely different kinds of food, I would say. So, yeah. I mean, there are similarities.
I mean, the terrain itself changes. So, speak to us a little bit about the land of Sweden. Does it go from tropical to, you know, tundra?
Not tropical, unfortunately. But we are an illustration of that. Lotta, she was born and raised up really in the very north of Sweden. And I was raised as far south as you probably can get. So it's like worlds apart. Up there, very few things grow, and it's a lot of snow. The vegetables are different, of course.
And people up north Sweden, they hunt, they fish, they forage. I mean, that's part of everyday life to actually be doing that. And down south, that's a food producing region with a lot of farmers, huge farmlands, and also with cattle.
But what we're trying to do now in Sweden is getting back to the what once was before we ruined it in 1956, where everything was supposed to be efficient and streamlined as everywhere else. But now we're trying to regain this, the history, well, our food heritage and our food history in a way, trying to resurrect things, trying to correct things. That's what we are in the process of right now.
So let's talk about a place like Fabrikan.
Yes.
Explain what that restaurant is and what it means to contemporary Sweden.
Well, let's remember that Fabrikan is a tiny restaurant with a huge impact, I would say. It's 12 seats, I would say, and it's more than, it's more like a project almost, what Magnus is doing. And but it's also very, very inspiring to many people and shows what can be done.
It's extremely unique. You go there, you stay in the middle of nowhere, and you're going for a meal that starts at 7 o'clock at night. Everybody has to sit down at the same time. It's a theater. It's
you're part of a play.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the produce is really, I mean, it's amazing. And the cooking is extraordinary.
What is the cuisine that he serves? What is the? What are some of the dishes?
Some of the dishes, I mean, one of the most photographed ones, I would say, or celebrated ones, is a scallop made in its own shell. And that is a beautiful dish. Mm. And it's served with fir tree branches and
a bit on fire smoking underneath.
Fire.
But it's all his food is deceptively simple. Like to me, all great food, it looks very, very simple, honest, and but it's in the quality of the produce and the way he treats it. It's very intelligent cooking, I would say.
But would you call it Swedish?
Well,
absolutely, I would say. I mean, it's Swedish, but
but the scallops are Norwegian.
But it's not classical Swedish. I wouldn't say classical Swedish.
It's
modern Swedish.
He went to France and worked at La Strance with Pascal Bobo, for instance, and he takes a lot from there, from France, I would say. His inspiration of the combination and the plating of dishes, and it's not over elaborate in any way. It's very thought through. It's like taking how many things can you take away and how can you concentrate flavors or components according to season in a very intelligent way. It's very daring.
Yeah, and he's a daring guy and he's doing things in a great way. I actually work with him now because he's opening a charcuterie factory. A small one, but it is a factory. So he's going to make charcuteries, Swedish classic charcuteries, and sell them. And then he has this idea that he's going to sell them in his county only. But if there is enough, maybe to the northern Sweden, and if it's even more, to the rest of Sweden. So that's his idea with it. I'm going to make charcuteries and sell them in my county.
So, if Magnus was here, it just seems very funny that the majority of people that I've spoken to today, though they're bringing their cuisine and their stories to Worlds of Flavor, it's more about being at the destination. How important is destination, ambiance, terroir to the majority of contemporary chefs?
It's everything, I would say.
Yeah, it's everything, and it's also that what makes it difficult for some of them, because they might be in remote areas. But it's everything taste and produce.
To me, it's almost everything, and that's what makes it interesting, because we're working now on our fourth issue. It's almost finished, and it's about Italy, and Italian gastronomy. And traveling Italy, meeting people, it's so evident. Like even the simplest tomato dish, you know, it's depending on the tomato from the place with the oil that is local. And people say that Italian food is easy to cook. It might be, but the limitation is the product. You have to have this cutting-edge product. Or, of course, you can go to a supermarket and buy the tomato and the rubbery mozzarella and some cheap olive oil, and you will end up with something that looks maybe close to the real thing, but taste-wise, no way.
But that is the beauty of the Italian cuisine, because Italian cuisine is really based upon produce from the region. extremely regional. It has been like that for thousands of years. And that's unique, I think.
Let's talk about Fool magazine. Because it wasn't always a part of your lives. Why was it concepted? Why did you need to feed yourselves with that kind of exploration?
It's passion, I think. We really wanted to do a food magazine that was different from the food magazines that were around. And it's not something that we make money out of. We're doing it out of passion.
Absolutely. It's kind of quite. When we met, Lotta was the art director of a very good gastronomic magazine in Sweden. And she wanted to work with photographers that didn't really do food in a traditional way. And so she phoned me up and asked me to do food. And I said no twice. And then you convinced me. And we started photographing food and then and people. And then we became a couple. And almost immediately we had this idea about creating a food magazine, a gastronomic magazine of our own. Because already back then, 10 years ago, we felt there was a need for kind of a product that would we could do our vision, I would say, of what a gastronomic magazine could be, forgetting about, well, not ad sales, because we need ads and we want to be but forgetting about things like the limitations, or trying to, like, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't put a serious guy in glasses and a black and white picture on the cover. Of course we can. We can't do 20 pages of something. Yes, we can. That's very much about believing ourselves and doing what we...
Yeah, now you sound like Obama, but but the thing is, yes, we can. But it's also about that we have met so many fantastic people during the years, traveling around and working for other magazines doing things. Mm. And we felt that these people... they didn't get the credit they really deserved. So we wanted to do it in a publication like Fool.
Who were some of your first subjects that you reached out to?
Oh my.
Yeah, we have this, I would say, collective... there's so many people we know out there. It, not only chefs, it's like producers. It's, and we keep on learning. Every day is like we're learning something new. And every new travel, every meeting leads to something new, new discovery. And that's what's interesting. So maybe, I don't know, among the first ones...
We did Magnus.
Yeah, for Fool. But you know, all this starts 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Even I would say, like, going to me, a really eye-opener was Mugaritz. When we went to Spain, Mugaritz just opened, and they were surprised, who are these guys from Sweden coming here? And we just met, so we were shooting them for Swedish Gourmet magazine back then. And that was like the first time I realized, this is so interesting, these people are so... And then we know Mugaritz and Andoni and all the staff there very, very well. I mean, been like following each other in a way. And then all of a sudden we felt like these people, we need to tell their story. And we did that in the first issue about what Mugaritz really was about, the creative team, how they work and all that.
It was so much fun because we were there the first time. They had been open for 2 years, I think. We're having dinner and we were served by servants who didn't speak any English at all. They spoke Basque, basically, putting plates in front of us without even doing presentation or anything, but the food looked amazing. We had never really seen anything like that before.
It was totally fantastic. Still is, but that was amazing.
And then we have been following them for 11 years, I think, and eating there almost every year. Every year we have, and sometimes even twice or three times. And to see how they have evolved, it has been extremely interesting to see.
So Fool isn't necessarily about trends or the fleeting restaurant or chef. It's about investing your time in a project or in a person for a long period of time.
Absolutely, because Fool has a shelf life that is really long. I hope.
That's our goal, at least. We're not outspoken, but it's a goal that you can pick up number one and still feel it's relevant today. And but still, I think we are extremely trendy. We are, of course, in many ways, we're extremely trend sensitive. But I don't know. We try to be ahead of the curve in a way, but it's we're almost like creating our own curve, I would say. Trying to trust ourselves and our judgment so much, and we have to in order to be unique. It's a bit like floating sideways, I think.
Yeah, it's because also that we're making fool out of passion. And before, when we have been working, being in at the publishing house, you're sitting at the office every day, and all the journalists and photographers, they're having all the fun. You don't really get to meet all these people, and we want to do that and let our how do you say it, our sense of these people that we're meeting come across in our magazine. That is extremely important to us, to do it this way
and go, and don't be, we're not afraid to fail. That's very, very important. We're not afraid to take a chance of fail, or like Italy now. We went on some missions, win or lose, and they turned out to be real winners. And they will be in the magazine, and that was very, very fortunate. And, you know, one meeting leads to something else, and it really is like jumping from, well, stones in the water, and sometimes you slip and you fall into the water, but that might not be a good thing after all, bad thing after all.
Let's talk about that entry point into Italy as a whole. And this isn't going to air until January through March of next year, so you
perfect.
Can talk about the Italy issue a little bit further if you'd like.
Yeah.
How, I mean, where in Italy did you start, and where did that journey take you?
Well, first, it's not only Italy. It's about Italian gastronomy, and it's all over the world. So it's Italian gastronomy from Brazil. It's from Australia, among some places. And then, of course, it's Italy.
And the US.
And US, of course, yeah. Sorry. it comes so natural to us. And where did it start? I think we did almost everything from the small island of Pantelleria, just off Africa, up to Milan. No, even to the Alps, I think we went.
Yeah, to the Alps.
Crisscrossing. Because I had this naive dream about this Italian issue. It was like, oh, we rent a car somewhere in Sicily, and we drive all the way up and you crisscross. And of course, it didn't work out that way. It was more like mentally it did, but...
You're always a romantic, I think.
That's my Italian side.
Yeah, so we're doing this. Our cover story is Massimo Bottura, Osteria Francescana, and it's written by Lisa Abend, who is here now, because we really wanted to do him in a different angle. But we have shot him extremely different as well.
And his staff.
We have made a fashion shoot out of this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's totally insane.
it's probably one of the most insane photo shoots involving a restaurant and a chef, and hopefully still with focus. It's set at a castle, and the castle is... well, they're in the process of renovating it, so it's kind of worn down. And we're taking a lot of inspiration from Fellini, the classic Fellini movies. And we work with a great stylist. It was kind of our biggest budget operation, I would say. And Massimo, when we were finished after 2 days shooting, he said, "This is one of the most fun shoots I've ever been to."
The Massimo way. "Hey guys, this is the most fun photo shoot I ever done."
Well, let's talk about styling, because you are the only photographer, or are there other artists that contribute to Fool?
There are.
For this issue, we will actually have a couple of other photographers working with us. I mean, PA shooting a lot of the shots for Fool is also an economical point. to be able to afford to do this magazine.
Yes, photographers, they, well, require huge salaries. No, no, that's not the thing, but it's also a creative thing. Like Lotta said, we so much enjoy doing this, and I have loads of, well, it's a pity sitting at a desk, seeing stuff being done that I feel I could have done and maybe done better, and, you know, that's what we want to do, want to express ourselves. But it's a bit of a problem finding photographers. Like you, when you were at Swedish Gourmet back like 70 years ago, we tried to find photographers with a different background that not necessarily shoot food. Just because we are a quote gastronomic magazine, unquote, photographers tend to send us images of food, and that we don't really want. We want somebody who can, with a unique language, image language, and we don't really care if they can shoot food. They rather do like great portraits or whatever. So we're looking very hard for people to, you know, work with that don't really fit the box.
How would you explain PA shoots food differently?
Oh, that is a different question and extremely difficult. I think he always uses natural light only, and it looks kind of funny when we're shooting the pictures, because it looks like we have some cardboards with us in black and white, just moving them around, and it looks kind of strange. And all the chefs, when they see us, when we're working like that, they are wondering, how will this end? And it always ends beautiful. But I think it's the approach to the food, and yeah, it's really hard to say. I don't know. I can't really explain.
And why take something so vibrant and colorful and strip it out and make it black and white?
We haven't done that many black and white shots, though. But we did a few in the last issue from Japan. But that was because that place, Miyamasu, was like traveling back in time. So it felt right to do them black and white, almost, those photographs.
There was very hard. I think we did like maybe 5-6 different variations from Miyamasu, this fantastic place in Japan. I was not content with what came out. It didn't feel Miyamasu. It didn't look Miyamasu. So I almost had to like rip the files apart in a way and put them together again to reach this kind of the feeling of Miyamasu, this mysterious place in the woods that's perfect but still imperfect in a way. It was very, very challenging to show in images, I think.
So, talking about being a photographer that doesn't shoot food, you also use influences that aren't food, like Fellini. What other kind of artistic and visual cues do you take?
Wow, I'm. It's kind of depressing because all the people I really love, all the photographers I really, really love, they're dead now. They're not with us anymore. The people I really, really would like to work with, like, you know, all the classics like Irving Penn, Avedon, and so many of the even older ones, you know, that went away much long time ago. But that is why it's hard to find. It's like food. We are all looking too much at each other. We're copying each other too much, photographers as well. Like all the chefs look at the blogs and the images, and they try to, some chefs, they are unique and they manage to do unique things without looking too much at each other.
It's really difficult to be innovative now, I think,
yes,
in food photography. And I think probably that's why we're doing the magazine, because we're not so much innovative maybe in the food photography, may I say, but we are innovative in how to make a food magazine more.
Let's talk about that same idea of social media and everyone being connected and related back to, you know, what's going on here today. How hard is it to be unique these days? Or is that even the point?
We never think about being unique, I think. We think about... We just look at something and we well, ourselves, we speak about it kind of... And we, I think we look very much into ourselves without thinking about being unique. We just do stuff we like. And hopefully with our background, our collective kind of, I don't know, experiences and everything, we are unique. It doesn't mean that a single image has to be unique. It's more... is unique in a different way, the product itself, I hope.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking about restaurants and how restaurants can be unique and dishes. You see all these images everywhere and it's so easy to copy, but it's not so easy to copy an experience, the atmosphere of being somewhere. And we work a lot with restaurants as well, doing... as consultants, sometimes we say that, oh, you should do like this, think like this. No, we can't do that, the chefs say, because he's doing that, or I don't want to copy anything like that. But it's hard to be unique in a world that is so global through internet. I think, and but it's also it comes down to talent, really. All these talents that are out there for some fantastic people, and they are unique.
Mm. I could not easily, but I could do things very, very complicated in every shoot. I could do the portraits, the most complicated thing ever. I could do food in a very, very complicated way. And I spoke to a chef, very good friend of mine in London, about this, about cooking, how to be innovative, and the pressure to be innovative in a way. And also I spoke about specifically about food photography, how to be inventive. And we both agreed it's the same thing. Do we really have to be innovative just for the sake of being innovative? Not really. It's down to some kind of other quality as well. If you have that quality, it's good enough. Well, not even good enough. That is the quality.
It's important to, being in a restaurant, you can't put an iPad on the table and show a movie and without thought behind it. You need to have a proper thought, an idea why you're doing all these things. Or just cook very good food.
And there's another reason about the magazine, how it looks. And I'm not the right person to explain this. You should do it, Lotta, but I'll try. It's very easy to design a magazine, not easy maybe, but you can design a magazine that's super cool and not readable at all. And that even obscures the content in a way.
Yeah, Fool is kind of boring in design, I would say, but it's readable, and people contact us all the time and say that it's fantastic. I'd read Fool from the first page to the last. I read everything, and I usually don't really read these magazines. I just leaf through them and look. But this magazine I'm reading, and that's best. What do you call it?
Well, that's the best feedback.
Feedback you can ever get. Yeah.
Let's not gloss over innovation. It's obviously a very big part of photography, design, and cooking. What are some of the more innovative things you've seen around the world in kitchens that chefs do? And then how do you translate that into the magazine?
Ooh, that's a very good question.
The most innovative thing that we came across recently is in Italy, actually. It's an Italian chef from Sardinia, and he's based in Sardinia as well. His name is Roberto Pezza, and he makes cheese, excellent cheese. And no chefs really makes cheese nowadays. And... in Sardinia, time has stopped. So people, farmers, and people everywhere in Sardinia are still making cheese. They are making their own olive oil and mirto, kind of liquor that they drink. That's why he's making cheese. But that's innovative, I think.
Mm, I agree. It's you have to almost go to a place like Sardinia and travel backwards in time to see the future in a way. Because a guy, a chef, making cheese just because they always done it, it's fascinating.
What kind of equipment do you shoot with? Do you shoot with modern or do you shoot with, you know, Hasselblads?
You should see, I have a huge collection of cameras. I never sell anything. So I have like everything from Hasselblad to Mamiya 6.7, 6.45. I have Canon, I have, you know, medium format, everything. And I shoot, mainly nowadays I shoot with digital Canon and Fuji. Fuji I really, really like. And then of course I have some medium format stuff I use when I have the possibility.
But when do you know which format pairs with, you know, each subject?
Well, that's a great question which I used to ask myself before, when there was both, you know, the choice between medium format or whatever, you know. Nowadays you can like tweak every file into something else, so it's a bit irrelevant, unfortunately. But I try to think, because sometimes doing I like to challenge myself, so choosing an equipment that challenges me a bit, it's good for me. But there are no real rules to it. It's very, very down to, I don't know, something else. The feeling of the moment, maybe.
You know, you get to travel and see how chefs cook, how people respond to that. But have you seen a trend on how people change the way they eat? Diners, non-restaurateur perspective.
It's different in different parts of the world, I would say. In Sweden, people now tend to dine out more than we have done before. And but if you go to a country like Spain or Italy, they've always been dining out.
Or Thailand, for instance.
Yeah.
I can't really see that it changes. I'm not that good at it. But for instance, Thailand that we went to and did a profile on, David Thompson, the incredible Thai chef from Australia, who's been there over 30 years now. They are changing their eating habits, definitely. Moving away from the traditional way of cooking that's very labor-intensive, it takes a lot of time, to more convenient fast food. And that's a big change.
But in this food scene now, I love the first episode of Portlandia and the chicken scene. I can't even speak about it because I'm laughing thinking about it. But that part of the dining scene has changed a lot. People ask about things, so where it's from, is it organic, how is it made, and all these things, because there's an interest in food and food TV and celebrity chefs and buying cooking books. But I don't know if it changes, has really changed how people eat. I'm not sure.
No, but it remains to be seen, I think.
Yeah.
The real impact of this.
But it's also part of, I mean, we're from Sweden, and we have been living in London for a while as well. And in Sweden and in England, you don't really have a culinary history. And we're creating it now, as they are doing in Denmark as well. We're creating a new history. We haven't seen the end of this yet. No. It's going to be extremely interesting to see how it is going to be in 10 years.
In Sweden, we are still in the process of, you know, getting food trucks. In some aspects, we're like 10 years behind the US or whatever, because of the regulations and everything. So some things takes time to catch up.
Next issue. Do you already have an idea in place, or does that come out of feedback?
You mean after the Italian issue?
Oh, yes. We know exactly what to do. Absolutely.
But it's tight-lipped.
No, not really. It's going to be... If you think this is dark, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to be very kind of looking at the darker sides of life, maybe, I think we can say.
Yeah.
Not saying too much.
Absolutely.
Exciting. I like the intrigue.
It's like a Hitchcock.
But, yeah. You know, that's the opposite of, I mean, I don't mean to, for you to speak poorly of, you know, gourmet Sweden, but how did they used to set up a shoot? It was the same, but it was a protocol. It wasn't really outside of the box.
Oh, I mean, the photographers, I mean, long time ago, everybody was working in a studio with flash. Some used a lamp, but they were rare. And the look of the food was completely different. But this is also, I mean, part of that type of photography is still going on.
In certain segments, yes, definitely, it does. Like if you pick up, there was a magazine in Sweden called like Allt om Mat, which is about everything about on food. My mother, we subscribed to it, and they published a picture like 2 weeks ago that could have been taken from my childhood, and I had a tweet about it because it was identical to when I read a magazine when I was 10 years old. So in certain segments, nothing has happened whatsoever. Mm. And in high-end cooking, yes, and high-end kind of photography of high-end cooking, it has. But I always say, people asking me, it's so easy to shoot great food that's plated in an intelligent way. And I try to work with these people because it gives me so much, you know, head start, rather than working with people who can't plate, who can't, you know, do things, don't have an idea. Because many of these chefs that we, well, most of them that we feature, they have very strong ideas.
And the old style food photography that is still going on, of course, is that you take a picture of a dish. That's what you do. But what I think is important is to take a picture of the food and try to let the smell, the sounds from the restaurant, and your overall feeling come across in that picture of the food. And that's the big challenge. Instead of just putting a white plate and perfect lighting, and that's that.
Well, you know how you were saying you hate seeing food portfolios. Talk to me about some of your favorite photos that aren't food related and why.
You start.
I can't. I have to think.
Oh, I can easily. There are a few photographers I really, really like and really admire. And I'm lucky enough to own, well, we are, a few photographs. I love Anton Corbijn's photography. I really do. I think it's the closest to what I like. That's kind of this imperfection and not being scared, working with, you know, with small equipment, which still can produce magnificent images. And we're lucky enough to own a few of them. And I would say that's like his image of Miles Davis in a hotel room in Amsterdam, which is basically nothing, just a portrait of a man. But it's so well done, so well executed. That's what I like, removing things in a way from an image, concentrating.
One of the most astonishing pictures I ever received as an art director is actually a food picture by PA, and he shot dessert, and when it arrived, it was at this time when you didn't do digital photography at all, so it was a print, and it arrived in, and we opened the envelope, and I was screaming, "Oh my God! God, what has he done?" So it was a dessert, and then this bee was flying above the dessert. And that was actually happening because it wasn't a Photoshop thing. It was the actual shot.
It just came, and I managed to press the shutter, and was there. But I don't know. No, come on. No,
but that was so much fun. Yeah, it made us happy when we received it.
But speaking, you must have some images that you love that's not food.
Yeah, I think one of the most astonishing images ever is the Vietnamese girl running from the napalm.
There are a lot of incredible images, and maybe we looked at, when doing this magazine, subconsciously, I think, we thought about Life magazine, being able to bring loads of photography in an interesting way. And we thought about, you know, the text of New Yorker, long and comprehensive and well executed. Mm-hmm. And, of course, fashion magazines like Vogue Italia, too. We kind of meld that together subconsciously, I think.
But it's something about that image with the Vietnamese girl running towards the photographer. Who is shot it? I forgot the name of the photographer. But anyway, she's naked. And if that picture would have been taken today, the editor would have not published it. Because she's naked, running towards the camera. And that is something that is extraordinary picture.
There's so many images that I doubt would be, published today. Like, also going back to Vietnam, the U.S. learned a lesson there in PR. Like a police chief of Saigon shooting a guy on an open on the street. I don't think that would make the first, the cover, page of New York Times today. I doubt it very much.
So what kind of food images aren't being shown today that should be shown?
Food images. Oh, God. Mm. I think anything goes.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Because, showing a slaughter, showing someone harvest an animal is still a slight faux pas. Yeah. Slight taboo in the food media world, yet we are able to talk about whole beast butchery. Mm. Why do you think it hasn't?
It's for the same reason I jokingly suggested to the Swedish Meat Organization. If you want people to really, you need transparency. You need to, people have to see things and that you do things well. And why don't install cameras in slaughterhouses, really, to see that thing. So you can go there and check it out, and they're well doing things well and properly and not mistreating animals. They were like, no, people don't want that. But it should be, it should be there, visible, if you want to have a look and to ensure quality in a way and transparency.
It was kind of crazy because at Mad Food Camp, the last thing that they did was themed Death Happens. And it was Alex Atala, he was on the scene, he was holding a chicken. And then he raised his hand and did the gladiator thing, thumbs up, down, and the audience started to scream, kill. So he killed the chicken. And then all these people sitting there, some of them thought that the chicken wasn't dead, even though he broke the chicken's neck. Because if you're killing a chicken, it continues to move. It doesn't just stop moving because of the spasm in the muscles. And that was absurd because you had all these chefs in this room and it seemed like they didn't know about this killing. I don't know. I walked out of the room actually because I felt bad when people started to scream, kill, kill. I think Alex, he should have said, people, be conscious here, say no to the killing. And because the other theme of Matt was also guts, so he should have had the guts to tell the people not to tell him to kill the chicken. But it was interesting. Death happens, and people don't know how.
Part of the dark place you're going in the next magazine, I assume. A little bit.
Nah, we'll see.
Is there anything else that you want to wrap up with in regards to the conference? Interesting people you've met, things you've tasted?
Regarding to the conference? Oh God, I just started. I think this is great fun. I love doing this speaking. Because every time we do an interview, we speak to people, we learn something about ourselves. And you get more focused. We met so many great people. We had breakfast with Nathan Myhrvold this morning, which is it's kind of cool. You walk out in the car and said, "Okay, we just have breakfast. with the kind of, you know, third guy of Microsoft. Okay, and he wants to meet us. That's cool. And, you know, that's interesting.
And he's doing an amazing thing with his books, completely different from what we are doing, extremely interesting in another way. Mm.
That's what's great about these conferences, where you actually meet people like that, and you learn things from each other, hopefully. Mm. And, yeah.
So what's more important, meeting the people or tasting the food?
Meeting the people, I think.
Meeting the people,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, definitely. Food is just food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.